everybody out there. My name is Alfie Cannock, and this is Dirty Thunder Radio Club. I am joined each and every week by the chair sniffer himself. It's
Pat Doherty. Hide your chairs, hide your stools, baby. I'm here, and I'm back to sniff up a couple of sitting ornaments.
Sitting ornaments. Yeah. Brilliant stuff, Pat. Yeah. You are the king of improv. That's what they say.
Absolutely not. But yes, Alfie, I'm good, my friend. You didn't ask, but I'll let you know anyway. I've had a great week. I've had a fantastic week. Dirty Thunder has been great this week, so I'm a happy boy.
Yep. So obviously the Monday, could you that crush? Wednesday was amazing, but what we need to talk about is Sunday night at Hemingway's Manly for the Pat Doherty Late Night Show.
That is correct. Are we going to keep talking like this?
Yeah. Yes? People love that. Listeners love that.
Oh, well, it was awesome, dude. One of our unofficial producers, Tom Schwab from Hemingway's.
He's been working hard
on the show with us, which is fantastic. And it was packed. It was absolutely chockers. We had Sean Dalton, the musician, performing. We had Anthony Lucasio, Marty Bright. Alan Rutledge absolutely destroyed, but the highlight was probably Sue Thomas.
Amazing, yes. Sue Thomas. So for anyone who doesn't know, Sue Thomas is this beautiful lady, this beautiful older lady, very unassuming, very lovely to talk to, but she writes the filthiest stories you've ever heard in your life. So what happens is she sits in the crowd, and then about halfway through the show, she just interrupts and decides that she's going to read some poetry. So we invite her up there.
And everybody was just assuming, here's my auntie, someone I relate
maybe
to
a
like
nice,
that.
Maybe a nice story about a dog.
Yeah.
Well, they did get a nice story about a dog. Unfortunately, it was about
a Sue jerking it off. With
to
a,
her dog or something like that. I don't
something
remember.
Like, I got out, yeah, but, I blocked it out, yeah. A lot of it.
But it was absolutely hilarious. It destroyed. And that is why you need to come to the Pat Doherty Late Night Show.
It's
every second Sunday.
That's right. The 15th of July is the next show. So make sure you come along to that. And make sure you come along to Coogee Bay Hotel on Monday nights, Hemingway's on Wednesday, Hive Bar on Thursdays. Follow Dirty Thunder for your information needs there. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm about to welcome our guest for the podcast today. She's worked beside Rachel Perkins and Wayne Blair on TV shows such as Redfern Now and Cleaver Man. Also been an assistant director of urban theatre projects Home Country for the Sydney Festival in 2017. Currently, she's writing her own short film called The Hunt. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the podcast, B. Cruz. Round of applause. I got that right as well. Cruz, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Cruz.
Yeah, that's cool.
Thanks, man.
No worries. How are you?
Pretty good. I'm pretty nervous, but yeah.
You seem so calm and relaxed anyway.
Oh, it's a facade, it's man. I've done a little bit of acting. That's about as good as it gets.
We saw. We were watching a couple of your monologues.
Oh my God, are you serious?
Yeah, you still have that audition video up there.
We'll talk about that in a little while. But that was sick. That was great.
Sweet.
It was very super emotional. I felt really emotional.
I cannot watch them over. I did them once. Like, I shot them, and then I think I watched it once, and then I've never been able to go back and watch it again.
Really?
Yeah, it's weird seeing my face and like getting all emotional and shit.
We were going to ask you about, but I reckon I can ask you now. Is it what is the whole process of doing an audition like that? Because you have to set up the camera, you're talking straight down the barrel.
So with those two, I used to work with. I do a lot of work with a company out west called Curious Works, and they basically support young emerging artists coming up through the film industry and theatre, I guess. So I met a lot of young people my age who want to get into filmmaking, and they basically helped me, you know?
Yeah.
I was like, look, I got to shoot a couple of monologues for a couple of auditions. Would you mind setting aside half a day? And, yeah, those two times I had two separate teams helping me film it.
Oh, dude.
It was pretty awesome. They're just really good mates of mine, and they're all in the same kind of area in film.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's great when I have little things like that. I just got a couple of friends out west who I can call and be like, look, I've got to do this real fast. My agent needs it this afternoon. Do you mind?
Yeah, and then whole team of people come with, like, cameras and sound stuff.
Oh, not a whole team. I wish. Nah. So the first one... Wait, what was the first one for?
The first one was for... The Good Doctor?
Yeah, so I actually wrote that one.
Yeah.
That was for an audition for Love Child.
Okay.
I thought I was a bit ambitious, kind of auditioning as a black doctor, considering it was filmed in the 60s and we didn't have rights those days.
Yeah, wow.
So that's probably why I didn't get the role. But that was actually manned by one friend of mine. His name's Sean Spinner, and he's awesome. He operated the camera, he operated sound, and we had lighting going all out at Casula Powerhouse.
Oh, cool.
So he was like a one-man show. And then the other monologue was filmed with Sean Spinner and another filmmaker, Adam McFillman.
Yeah. And what was that one for again?
That was my audition for After the Apology.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
So that script was given to me. That piece that I read was actually an excerpt from, I think it's the Bringing Them Home report.
Oh, yeah, right. That was heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's, again, what prompted the tears in that monologue, but it's kind of like telling the story of my grandmother and what happened with a lot of my family, because it's all about like stolen generation, taking children, Aboriginal children, away from their family.
Mm-hmm.
So that one, on an emotional level, really connected with me. So
yeah, you could tell it was, that was really moving. That really was. It must. That's a. To be able to have such weight behind when you're performing something like that, it would be an incredible feeling.
Yeah. And it's a little bit overwhelming too, because I'm not, like, I don't consider myself an actor.
Right.
I'm a storyteller. But acting is a craft that I've kind of learnt through my work as a director or through my work as an assistant on different productions.
Mm-hmm. I might just say that everybody listening at home, B is a storyteller, filmmaker, a theatre buff, gender neutral model. So that's the bio there as well. And then I also have you, you're of Aboriginal, American Indian and Chinese ancestry. That's what I found online.
Yeah. Well, you've definitely done
my research. Look at that whole page, dude. I'm so good at this.
Oh, that's brilliant, man.
Yeah.
I feel like you could do this interview without me.
Well, it really helps to have you here, actually.
Yeah. Oh, that's mad, man.
Yeah. And so you're a storytelling, but you... sorry, I interrupted. You were talking about that you just acting came on the side of everything else that you do.
Yeah. So I felt like, to me, learning the craft of acting was more about strengthening my skills as a writer and a director.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like if I understood the craft of acting more and being able to perform myself, it will make me instinctively a better writer and
be able to
direct actors better.
Sure.
So, yeah, like looking at my resume, I've kind of jumped around and everything, but it's all been strategy to kind of build me up.
Sure, yeah, just getting better at every single thing so that holistically you're a better director at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. And when, how did you get into theatre and film and directing and all that kind of stuff?
Well, when I was 12 years old, my great auntie Iris Clayton told me I was going to be the storyteller of my family.
I read that somewhere. Yeah.
Of course you did.
Of course I did. She was very close to you?
She was very close to me as a kid. She passed away when I was 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, I never got to learn all those cultural elements to it, you know? Like, she used to be able to speak language. She knew about law. She's written poetry. She used to work in government, you know?
Yeah, right.
A
Renaissance woman.
Yeah, she's amazing. So, yeah, before I got into the arts, after high school, I got into politics thinking I was going to make some amazing radical change. I was working with my local MP. And then when I went to South Africa for volunteering, I got offered a job over there with the ambassador. I think his name's Adam. Adam McCarthy, I believe his name is. So he offered me a job, and that whole political career came very real.
Yeah, right.
So when I came back to Australia, I had to make a decision if that's where I wanted to be. But I realised that politicians down in Canberra aren't going to listen to a little black duck from Western Sydney. Like, I was very early 20s. I wasn't very experienced in life. So I just wanted to take a step back and reevaluate the situation. And as I was doing that, I guess I went down some spiritual path, and I guess my auntie Iris pointed me in the right direction.
Yeah, right.
And when that happened, that's when I met Rachel Perkins, who's a bit of a family friend. My mum and my grandparents know her and her dad, Charlie Perkins.
Yeah. And Rachel Perkins started Blackfella Productions.
Blackfella Films.
Blackfella Films. Yeah. Yeah, right.
She's awesome. She's kind of like the Kate Blanchett of the black arts, you know.
Oh, wow.
She's the bomb diggity.
Yeah.
So growing up, she was always someone I'd looked up to.
Sure.
And then my mum introduced me to her at Yarburn, and I freaked out. I was like, this is Rachel Perkins' mum. What am I doing talking to her? Mum's like, just be cool, be cool.
Be cool. Yeah. Be cool.
And I'm standing there like, I'm cool, man. Trying to sort myself out. And then Rachel let me come on to Redfern Now and be her attachment on film, for a television series, sorry. And that blew my mind away, you know. Like, I loved storytelling as a kid. I used to write a lot as a kid, but I never thought that I would ever walk onto, like, a film or television set.
Yeah, sure.
Or see, like, Rachel Perkins and Wayne Blair and Leah Purcell and all these other, like, big fellas that I've seen throughout my life, you know, on screen.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was a little bit chuffed considering that was my first...
That's...
My introduction.
Yeah. I mean, Redfern Now is so critically acclaimed, and for that to be, like, your first step, your first foray into film and TV.
I'm very, very blessed in that regard.
Has everything else been a disappointment since? Did you peak too early?
No, not really, man. Like, oh, actually, no, come to think of it, maybe I did peak too early.
Can't happen.
Nah. No, it's all been a learning curve, hey? Like, for me, I take jobs in film, in television, in theatre, live performance. And it depends on what the heart of the art does, you know? So I'm a very heartful kind of person, and I believe that art can change the world, to get all, you know, philosophical for a moment.
Yeah. No, I'm into that. I love that.
That's why I can't stick to just film, or I can't stick to just theatre. I'm a bit of an arts whore. You know, I kind of jump around.
Yeah, sure. You're just experimenting a little bit over here with poetry or whatever,
dabble
maybe.
Over
and then,
here,
yeah,
and
exactly.
Over there, and yeah.
Playing hard to get in the arts. That's the, you know.
Ooh, I like that one.
Yeah, hard. Does that almost rhyme a little bit? I feel like, potentially. So when did you work on Cleaverman after Redfern Now?
Cleverman came...
Oh, Cleverman, I apologise.
Oh, that's all good.
I said it was Cleverman.
I thought it was... I got confused. My bad.
Yeah, this happens.
Yeah. I mean, I can research, but reading is like... I'm working on that.
That's okay. So when was Cleverman? I think we shot that around 2013, 2014... Or it could have been after that, sorry. I'm hopeless with these years because I've just been on so many different things.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, Cleverman came after Redfern Now, and it was awesome because Wayne Blair and Leah Purcell were the directors. They were the directing team.
Mm-hmm.
And I just came on set as a extra. One of my, my agent actually sent me on as an extra, so I was doing a lot of background kind of work. And I was blown away because there were all these, like, I call them, like, black royalty, all these fellas that I've seen on TV since I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I was really chuffed. And then Wayne Blair walked over to me and said, oh, hey, how you going? Just come and hang out when you're not needed on set.
Oh, dude, that's so nice.
And I kind of just, like, shit myself. I was sitting around with a bunch of other, you know, low-key actors. We're all extras just sitting around. And then, he walks over to me. He's like, oh, hey, B, how you going? And he remembered me from Redfern Now. Wow. My jaw dropped.
That's so nice, dude.
Yeah. No, he's a lovely man. I really observed how he worked on set and kind of how he worked with the actors and the team and that. And he's definitely someone I kind of look up to like that as a director.
That's for somebody to be so well-respected but also just be really nice and humble as well. Mm. It makes the person seem so much... better in life, because I was an extra in this TV show recently, and they were, you know, they do separate, like, the extras are over there and then, like, the main cast is over here. And then the cool members of the main cast, the people that I recognized and stuff, would come over and just hang out with everybody and not be like, so, oh, you know, this is, everyone's here because of me kind of situation. And the people that did act like that, they were the least interesting ones to watch when everyone was acting. Do you know what I mean? So I think it's it goes hand in hand with being a good person and being good at what you do. It's just like,
because we're all there working together, you know. And, like, working with Rachel showed me that. When I was on set with Rachel, because I was there for about 3 or 4 weeks, when I went in there, I was like, nah, I want to learn everything. I want to be a sponge. I just want to just soak it all up. That's what I mean, like an arts whore. I just wanted to take in the whole experience.
Sure.
And then I wanted to kind of be like, I wanted to be like an Ivan Sen, you know, just like write, direct, shoot, edit, just do everything myself.
Yeah.
But working on set with those fellas, I realized you have to work as a team.
Yeah, right.
And it really is teamwork at this whole other level. Like, I've worked amongst team, but a film crew, when you can get your film crew to just mold together nicely, it just makes the whole production so much smoother.
Yeah, right.
From down to your extras to your director and your producers, you know, every kind of level of the chain.
Yeah. That particular, again, that thing that I'm trying to relate here, that they ran that TV or that TV movie so smoothly. Mm. And I was in a bit of awe about it. Like, just being like, yeah, okay, you're not needed here, or, like, you need to come in this time. And then, like, there was just one person that was just getting everybody organized. I can't remember what position that's called. Somebody that's in charge of all the cast and crew. What is that?
Would probably be, like, your third AD or something.
Third AD. Yeah, dude, she was amazing. She just had that down to a T. Man. It was unbelievable. But did you have any filmmakers or anything like that you really idolized growing up?
I watched a lot of, like, American Hollywood films growing up.
Yeah.
So, like, I guess throughout high school, my most impressionable director was Tim Burton.
I love Tim Burton, dude.
Just because, like, the way he thinks, and when, like, when he writes, and because I used to love drawing as well, so I used to stalk all his drawings and stuff. But, yeah, the way he writes and the way he can project it onto screen and just transform you and take you into this obscure world that he's created, he just does it so brilliantly, you know? And as a kid growing up, even Beetlejuice, like, as much as it scared the crap out of me as a kid, I'm like, this guy has got it going on.
Yeah, he's scared the shit out of me in a real stylish way.
Yeah. Like, I wanted that suit. I still want that suit. When I get rich enough, I'm going to get one of those suits.
Buy Beetlejuice suit? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, man, that's boss.
Yeah.
For the moment, you just have to settle for the tights, the black milk Beetlejuice tights.
Yeah, that's me. On budget now.
We're all wearing those in the studio, actually.
Yeah,
you guys can't see at home, but I assure you we're all wearing black milk Beetlejuice tights.
Yeah, we insisted after last
week. I wanted to wear Galaxy, but...
Yeah. No, it had to be uniform.
Yep.
That was the thing.
Part of the team.
Yeah. What other Tim Burton films are you a big fan of?
So when he came out with Alice in Wonderland, that actually surprised me.
That was relatively recent, right?
That came out, like 2, maybe 3 years ago. Like, the first one, because I think there's 2 now. But, yeah, because I wasn't really interested in the first Alice in Wonderland. I liked the book and the story, mm-hmm. but I wasn't really a fan of the cartoon. And then I saw Tim Burton's take on it, and I just, I probably was a little bit biased because I was totally in love with Johnny Depp in those days.
Oh, it was Johnny Depp in a Tim Burton film.
Yeah, yes. surprise.
Surprise. Yeah. But, yeah, he played the Mad Hatter, who was always my favourite character. So, yeah, that one just really took me by surprise. I was not expecting to like it, but I had to go and see it at the movies because, you know, supporting my man.
Yeah, of course. I'm sure he really appreciates that as well.
Well, you know, if you're listening.
Yeah, exactly. He is actually one of our listeners, funnily enough.
Oh, yeah. We had to block him on Twitter. He was too needy, always messaging us.
So. Yeah, it was crazy.
Oh,
yeah, exactly.
Calm down. He can stalk me any day.
We'll definitely tag him in it. Just, you know, maybe what if it... I think he's happily married.
Oh my gosh, either way,
whatever. It doesn't matter.
Should we do our script, Pat?
Oh, yeah. So you remember how I was mentioning that we did, like, that maybe we'd do a segment or whatever?
Sure.
Yeah.
All right. We're putting you on the spot here a little bit, but because you're a budding director and, you know, Alfie and I want to have a good credit to our name.
Yeah.
We're going to ask if you could direct us in a little read through right now.
Yeah. So what we've done one is we've chosen a piece close to our hearts. Now, are you familiar with the movie Home Alone?
Oh, that was me growing up. What are you talking about? Yeah.
Dude, Home Alone.
So this is the script from the movie within a movie called Angels with Filthy Souls. Remember the gangster movie? So, Pat, I believe you're going to play Johnny.
Yeah.
And I'm going to play Snakes. So how would you direct this scene?
Okay, so...
We really have put her on the spot.
We really have, yeah. This is what we do on Dirty Thunder Radio Club.
Can I just get 2 seconds to read?
Yeah, no worries.
We'll talk about characters here.
You've seen... How many times have you watched Home Alone? Because I've seen it a million times.
This was from the one without Macaulay Culkin. Oh, no.
No, this is the first.
This is from the first one?
Yeah.
I've seen all of them probably like 5 times each. Yeah. Yeah, but I actually thought the third one was the best without Macaulay Culkin.
Oh, that is disgusting.
No, dude, that was the one. That was so good.
Oh, we're now a movie podcast.
Yeah, exactly. We only discuss Home Alone movies.
Yeah. It was my favorite movie growing up, and I dreamed of being left, like every kid, I dreamed of being left at home, invaded by gangsters, the burglars.
Yeah.
Like, I think the reality of it would have been a lot worse than the Hollywood version, now that I think about it.
More than likely. That was my undoubtedly, dream. In fact. But I've got an idea for my character. Have you got any ideas, B, how you want to do this?
Yeah, how should I play Snakes?
Well, I guess you'd probably look at the script first and just see what kind of genre you'd want it in. Because you could take it as it is, which is a script from Home Alone.
So traditionally it was a film, this was that film noir gangster.
Yeah.
Yes. But
you could play it as the gangsters.
Yeah.
Or we could totally manipulate
it. Oh,
the hell
we need to
it.
Manipulate it. What yeah, do we sure. Do? What do you think?
We could totally turn it into like a romantic kind of scene.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. Love it.
I'm on board with this.
I love messing with the entire system. So, yes. You know.
Well, you've probably picked up on Alfie and my romantic attention
already.
The
overture is, yeah. So we'll bring that to
the. I'm feeling that in the air. Is that what it is?
That's what it is. It's just, it's his scent. I just love it. I just love his scent.
Pheromones.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so what we would do first is just a general read-through to get a feel of the lines. Okay. No romance.
No romance.
No romantic king.
Oh, so I need to turn it off a bit. Like, okay, that'll be hard,
we need to
but I think I can do
tone
it.
Tone down this tension a little bit, guys.
I can't
might
look
need
at him
to
in
separate
the eyes.
Yous.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Get your hand off me, Alfie. I love it, but not right now. Come on.
Okay.
So you have to call action.
Is that how it works?
Not generally through a reading like this, but we can.
Yeah, should we do it anyway?
We can.
I have the hiccups, by the way, so I'm going to incorporate that into the character.
Yeah.
So we're just going for our first reading of the gangster scene from Home Alone 1.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Quiet on set. Action.
Who is it?
It's me, Snakes. I got the stuff.
Leave it on the doorstep and get the hell out of here.
All right, Johnny, but what about my money?
What money?
AC said you had some dough for me.
Is that a fact? How much do I owe you?
AC said 10%.
Too bad AC ain't in charge no more. I got another line.
That's why we do a first reading.
Yeah, exactly. This is how the professionals do it, Alfie, I told you. He'll call you when he gets out. Pause. Hey, I'll tell you what I'm going to give you, Snakes. I'm going to give you to the count of 10 to get your ugly, yellow, no-good keister off my property before I pump your guts full of lead.
All right, Johnny, I'm sorry, I'm going.
1, 2, 10. Keep the change, you filthy animal. What do you think?
How are we doing so
Pretty
far?
Pretty good?
Yeah.
I'm excited.
This is great. I'm loving it.
So now can we do it with the romance?
I'm loving the energy, guys.
Yeah.
Such beautiful thespians.
Yeah. I probably... You don't have too many notes for me, I imagine, but how can Alfie be better?
I'm not going there.
Okay, so for here, we're going to go for... I need a little bit of water to clear my throat there.
Yeah. Acting.
We're going for romance here, so...
So you got to just... You gotta feel it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'm feeling like there's tension, which in any good script, you need a good dose of tension.
Mm-hmm.
So make that romantic tension. So maybe Johnny's done something really bad to Snakes.
Okay. All right.
But it's a part of the actor's kind of journey to figure that out.
All right. We can do this.
And that's what makes a really good actor because... when you watch an actor, you watch what they're thinking, not just what they're saying.
Yeah, okay.
All right. you got to feel those words.
Okay.
All right.
And I noticed in your monologues you took a second always to... Compose. To get in the zone.
Oh, you really need to ground yourself. Yeah. Otherwise, you just lose yourself in all this all mess right. you're reading.
All right.
Romance. All right. Here we go, Pat.
Feel it. Whenever feel the love, ready, guys. Baby, feel I'm the ready. Love.
Okay. Here we go.
Is everybody ready on set?
Everybody ready? Yep, I think so.
Okay.
Quiet on set and action.
Who is it?
It's me, Snakes. I got the stuff.
Leave it on the doorstep and get the hell out of here.
Look, all right, Johnny, but what about my money?
What money?
AC said you had some dough for me.
Oh, is that a fact? How much do I owe you?
AC said 10%, all right?
Too bad AC ain't in charge no more. He'll call you when he gets out. Pause. Hey, I'll tell you what I'm going to give you, Snakes. I'm going to give you to the count of 10 to get your ugly yellow no-good keister off my property before I pump your guts full of lead.
All right, Johnny, I'm going. I'm sorry.
1, 2, 10. Keep the change, you filthy animal. We did it. I think we nailed that. Acting. What do you reckon?
I'm going to go home and watch Home Alone now.
Yeah, exactly. To see how it's done properly rather than just...
I just want to reimagine this whole scene again.
Yeah.
But just in romance.
Yeah, so Angel with Filthy Souls. They should have made a full movie because they first shot that just deliberately for that one scene to make it like as part of that movie.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I never knew that.
Yeah,
that
was so it wasn't actually a real movie. It was just a silly, pardon me, scene that they wrote.
How do you get rid of hiccups, B? Because there's been
I got rid of them before, but they're back.
Yeah.
I'm really awkward about my hiccups. So, like, I hold my breath. Like, I take a deep breath and hold my breath for 40 seconds.
Yeah.
So I count back from 40. And then when I hit 20, I say 20. And then just keep counting down to zero.
This is just in the middle of you doing whatever you're doing. In the day, so people don't really know that you've got the hiccups, and then you just
20. Yeah, so I'm sitting there like, and then 20.
Oh, that's so good.
And then one.
You get hiccups quite often, so people are just like, "Yeah, B, she'll yell out." They think you have like Tourette's, but only
sometimes.
With numbers.
I feel like people think that when I don't have the hiccups.
Look, podcast listeners, they love the hiccups. It adds a point of difference to our podcast. Don't even worry about it.
It's like listening to vinyl as opposed to MP3.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly.
You get a little skip. The impurities in the track. Yeah. That's
what really makes it. Exactly right. Dude, I like your worldview on things. This is fantastic.
Yeah, man.
Well, in our pre-chat, we were chatting about you have recently taken up being a drag king. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. I forgot about this completely.
Tis true.
So you've said you're new to this. You've only done one show.
We've done a huge leap here, but I love the subject change. Yeah.
So, yes, I have recently... I feel like I've, like, come out again.
Oh.
As a drag king.
Yeah.
So my stage name is Bedazzled Shanks.
Bedazzled Shanks?
The Prince of Redfern.
Oh, fantastic.
I did my first show earlier this year at Carriage Works. There was a big cabaret called Kurigra,
mm-hmm.
and they have this thing. It's kind of around Mardi Gras time, so it's a big black queer event. I get to see all my black family and that.
What's it called again? I'm sorry.
Kurigra.
Oh, I've heard about this before. Yeah.
So it was its second year this year.
Oh, how cool.
As a part of it, the producer brought in a First Nation Canadian to do a storytelling workshop.
Mm-hmm.
Her name was Cherish Violet Blood.
Yeah.
She was so awesome.
What a name.
We went in the week before Kurigra to do a storytelling workshop. I had no idea what my story was going to be. I just assumed it was a drag show.
Yeah, right.
I don't know why I assumed. I just did. So I went in there thinking, how am I going to make a drag? Like, I'm not a performer, you know?
Yeah, right.
The whole idea, the fact that I signed myself up for it just freaked me out the whole week. And then next minute I had like a latex bloody G-string on over my pants, a sock down my pants. Like, I was throwing cream everywhere. It was great.
Dude, this party sounds amazing.
Oh, that was just my performance. Oh, right. There was much partying afterwards as well.
Yeah, right.
So yeah, and then that was my kind of first, I guess, coming out as a drag king story. And I got to perform with heaps of drag queens that night as well.
Yeah, right.
And I'd known a few of them because they kind of, in the queer black circles, it's very small, kind of know them from around the traps.
Sure.
So, yeah, I was just chilling out and everything. And then a few weeks back, Nanamus Khoury, one of the black drag queens around Sydney, asked if I wanted to be a part of a show that's coming up at the end of this month. It's called Urban Dreaming at the Columbian Hotel.
Oh, cool. They're on the corner of Oxford Street and Crown.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know it well.
Yes.
One of the best dance floors in town.
Oh, really?
Apparently.
Oh, awesome. I haven't been to Oxford Street in a while, so I'm thinking I might have to go there either this weekend or next weekend and suss out the stage.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I'm a little bit nervous.
So what are you? What will it be? Another latex G-string and cream sort of affair, or how are you going to go about it?
I'm not too sure.
Yeah.
Well, I performed Cream by Prince for my first show.
Yeah, okay.
So I'm feeling like Cream is kind of my character's song. I feel like...
Yeah, yeah. What about you could go like other Cream-related songs as well? Like you could go... there's got to be another Cream. I was thinking Smoke on the Water by Cream. Is that Cream?
That's Deep Purple. Love.
What the hell? Is there a band called Cream?
Yes.
There is a band called Cream. I knew it. Clapton. Oh, right.
Yeah, I don't think that's the genre that I'm going for.
Fair enough, dude. I get it.
I'm a bit into rock music and all that, but yeah, wouldn't go down that road.
That's exciting. That's so cool.
I've been so nervous about it, but I'm just, because it's coming up the 28th and I have to finalize I'm doing two songs this time. Mm-hmm. I only got to do one song at the start of this year, but now I'm doing two songs. So yeah, I feel like I've kind of leveled up a little bit in my drag persona.
And it's such a quick ascent.
Yeah.
Like from one show. When was Khoury Grass?
Khoury Grass. The week before Mardi Gras.
So what's that? April?
Is it? I think March, early March.
Oh, okay, yeah, right.
Around that time.
So you got to check out the stage. You got to, I assume, get your costume organized. Choose another song. What other preparation is there for?
So a part of my Cream song, I schmooze the audience and kind of like tell them all sleazy pickup jokes, and it's so out of my own character. Like B. Cruz, the person, is so not sleazy.
I'm trying to picture this because it's actually so difficult.
It's so weird,
imagine.
Hey?
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's not in my character, but that's why I love it, because it's so different to me.
Yeah, sure.
So when I get up there, instead of taking on this whole emotional thing like I did for those monologues, I let B. Cruz go.
Yeah, right.
I'm like, just get over it. You are now the Prince of Redfern. Strut your shit around this stage like you own it.
That's awesome, dude.
And that's pretty much what got me through the night.
Yeah,
just
right.
Just this one solid thought. And a little bit of rum.
And a little bit of rum as well. There's got to be,
yes.
I assume.
Just a little bit.
Wow, that's so cool. 28th at the Columbian. Alfie, we got a schedule that we can we come and watch?
You can definitely come and watch.
That'd be awesome.
That would be amazing.
Everybody listening as well, if you're interested, come and check it out. That'd be crazy. I wonder if Fox is performing as well.
Not sure.
Well, that said as well, I've got some other questions to ask you about some other things that you do. Can you explain what the Creative Futures program is that you're a part of?
Is that through the National Theatre of Parramatta, yes?
That was through, correct, yeah.
So I'm not too familiar with that program. I think it's an ongoing program.
Was it? Maybe I've got the wrong thing. A mentor scheme established to further opportunities for Western Sydney professionals.
Yep.
That was, and
so that scheme gave me an opportunity to go and work.
Changing gears really quickly here, by the way. I apologize.
That's all good. That scheme through the National Theatre of Parramatta got me a job with Riverside Theatre.
Yeah.
On a production called Stolen.
That's what I was going to ask about. Yeah.
So I was just some like I said, young black duck from Western Sydney.
Yeah.
I didn't really have any theatrical background.
Yeah.
Except that I'd studied drama in high school and did. what is it called, entertainment in high school. So I had some understanding of like production in theatre.
Yeah.
So yeah, I found out about that program. I applied and surprisingly I got it because I was over the moon about that job. Because Stolen was always a story that hit home for me.
Sure.
Again, about the Stolen Generation. It's based around five characters who have very different stories and individual stories to tell, but they jump between characters and take on other characters throughout the play.
Yeah. And you were working as an assistant director on this?
Yeah. So I was the assistant to the director, which I think there's a slight difference.
Okay, sure.
The director's name is Vicky Van Hoot, and she's amazing. She's a trained NASDA dancer.
Uh-huh.
And she was saying that it was like her first time coming into theatre like this. She's done other productions or been a part of helping other productions with choreography and dancing, but yeah. She's never directed her own play.
Yeah, sure.
So, working with her was just really mind-blowing because I'd done a few film television productions. Stolen was my first theatre production.
Mm-hmm.
And it just opened up my mind to a whole other level of storytelling.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's such a... It's a very long process. Like, filmmaking is a very long process too, but it's so involved and so intense in theatre. Like, I remember being in rehearsals for, like, 3 weeks before the play opened.
Yeah.
And sometimes me and the other actors or me and the actors would walk out crying just because we'd have such a hard day because the director just ran us into the ground or, you know, they had to go over a scene like 20 times or something. Yeah.
And that would be so crazy to go through such a emotional scene like 20 times, just have to be that in that space for however long.
Definitely.
How many times.
Definitely.
Yeah. Do you think that the being in theatre is so much more potentially consuming because you're directly involved in so many other character developments? Like... You're seeing characters develop as well as the whole play as a whole developing?
Do you mean as from a director's perspective?
Yeah.
Well, I feel like a good director in any discipline has to have a good understanding of the whole story.
Uh-huh.
Because that's the director's job to portray that, you know? So if you don't understand a character or where they're going, like the just one individual character...
Yeah.
Then it's hard to kind of... have those metaphorical tricks in film and television, you know, like the magic of cinematography.
Yeah, sure.
And the whole metaphor behind why that guy's tying his shoelace or why that person's shirt's red, you know, like little details like that. I think having a very strong understanding of every character in the story is, a little bit key for a director.
Yeah, right. And with... Jumping from there to the new short film series that you're writing at the moment, The Hunt, and you're going to be directing that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Can you tell us about that a little bit? What's that all about?
So that's a story I've been kind of. It's one of my unicorn projects.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have those unicorn like fluffy projects, and then you have those workhorse projects that pay the bills, kind of thing.
Oh yeah, 100%.
So The Hunt has been a bit of a unicorn project for me for the past 2 years. But it's a 3-part short film series.
Sure.
So if you watch each film individually, it's a standalone story, but if you watch it as a whole, it's a series. It's basically around the story of this... I feel like I need to tell you where it came from before actual story.
Yeah, yeah, please.
So I used to be a tour guide at Barangaroo, and I remember one day I was walking with my bloody cowboy hat and my big boots, and I had a spear and a nulla nulla in my hand. And nulla nulla is like it's a bundi, a club.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Caveman club. And I was walking around Barangaroo with those to show the kids, and there were so many people scared of me.
Really?
I'm like, is it because I'm black? Like, if there's a white tour guide holding this, are they going to be feeling more comfortable about, like, I don't know what to do.
Yeah, right.
And then I just thought, you know what? stick this. And I just put the spear over my shoulder and I just walked up like I was like king shit. It was awesome. But then came this idea, like I saw my shadow with my cowboy hat, my boots. And you could tell that I was from like this day and age, very contemporary look. And then I had my spear and my nulla nulla and I was like, I like that whole
juxtaposition of the two.
That kind of timeless thing about it. I don't know. So the hunt came from my shadow, I guess. And it started off, the first part is basically how men hunt and gather. And hunting back in traditional times was very much men's business.
Sure.
Women were seen as more as gatherers. They could go out and hunt small game, like little lizards and whatnot, but they weren't known for going out and getting kangaroo and whatnot. So my idea was to take, to make the audience think that the whole film was about the boys and the men's business. So in part one, we follow the men hunting, and then at the end, the chief of the tribe comes in and gives the family their food, and his son is sitting there playing with a nulla nulla.
Yeah, right.
And then this father says, I'm going to help you, I'm going to teach you how to hunt one day. And then we think that part two is going to be opening up on his story.
Yeah.
But it's actually opening up on his twin sister's story.
Oh, cool.
So she's a very spiritual kind of character, and that's what the story is. It's about, it's a woman's story.
Right.
The audience thinks that it, you're meant to believe it's a men's story because it's got hunting and it's got a lot of men's business in it. But yeah, it's kind of a, it's, that's why it's taken me so long, because it's got cultural content. It's very hard to kind of just be all willy-nilly about throwing cultural content out like that.
Yeah, sure.
I need to think about the lore that I'm portraying. I need to think about the language group that I'm portraying.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to be my family story or if it's going to be somebody else's story. It's purely, like, it just came out of my head, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I'm terrified to put it out there because it's a portrayal of my culture.
What do you mean?
Like, There's a lot of debate around telling truth in Indigenous culture and letting us own our own stories.
Sure.
So it's one thing for a non-Indigenous person to come out and say, I want to do an Indigenous story, and then it gets a little bit tokenistic. You bring in the blackfella and da-da-da.
Uh-huh.
But when blackfellas tell their own stories, we still get, you know, criticised and whatnot.
From the community, from the Aboriginal community.
From the community.
Yeah, but right.
Like Clever Man, that was such a lengthy process before the script was even written, before they even went to production.
Yeah, right. Because you had to
There's so much consultation behind the script. And that's 90% of Indigenous art is consultation and making sure you're telling these stories right and giving them truth.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm not just trying to tell a story and... If I was, like, a bit of a boss lady, I would have just written it and filmed it and been like, yeah, here you go.
You could deal with
it. Take this.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
But I know that my family would be like, what the hell? Why didn't you speak to me about this?
Yeah, right.
Where did this story come from? What? There's no truth in this. And then I'm going to have to bloody explain to my elders. I don't care about the next director who thinks that it's a great story or anything. I've got to go back home someday. I'm worried about them fellas there jumping down my throat.
I really appreciate that element of Aboriginal artistry, that communication between everybody in the process of making whatever type of art it is.
Yeah.
You know? I think that's something that is gives it more weight comparatively to, like, an anglicised piece of art, you know, which is sort of like the individual, whereas an Aboriginal story or whatever just seems like it's more communal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I haven't done a lot of work in the mainstream. Well, when I say mainstream, I mean anything outside of the Indigenous arts. I haven't done much work in that spectrum just yet, because I like how when I go onto a set or a production, it's like my family, you know?
Yeah, right.
Even though they're not physically related to me, like, I'm comfortable with them. I can have conversations with them that I can't on a non-Indigenous production, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And about the work, we can talk about the work and everything and dive into those deeper layers and whatnot, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas if I was working on, like, if Red Fern Now had a production team that was 80% white fellas, that story would have not got told the way that we saw it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And And we all have, like, we've got a lot to learn from that, you know, like not just Indigenous fathers, but everybody in the arts. I feel like we need to take more time in our processes and in our development phases, ask the right questions, make sure you're not, like, it's one thing to be gung-ho about this, but you don't need to be disrespectful.
Of course, yeah. That is a good thing to take on board. I think we're all good. I've really appreciate you coming through and talking to us and everything like that.
Thank you.
Not at all. Thank you heaps. Oh, one thing that I did want to ask you just before we head off, because the way that I discovered about yourself was that I saw that you were talking at Listen Here Now at Vivid Ideas.
Yeah.
So it was saying that Listen Here Now will give the next generation of Aboriginal art practitioners the platform to voice their vision for the future of the art, screen and culture. And I thought maybe a good idea was potentially asking you what your vision for the future arts and screen culture of Aboriginal art practitioners is. If that's a giant question, I apologize, but
that is a bit of a loaded question.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm back on that panel.
Ah.
Nah. For the future for black arts, you know, I wish there was a future that didn't need that term black arts.
I agree.
I wish it was just arts. I wish I was just a storyteller, not a black storyteller, not an Indigenous storyteller, not a cultural storyteller. You know, just a storyteller. If we can work together to make that happen, I'll be happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I love that. That's a fantastic.
Sorry, I'm a little bit sentimental at times.
No, that's good. Yeah. Dude, I really appreciate your energy. To be honest, it's calming me right down. I feel fantastic.
I can see your energy changing. You just sit back in your chair a little bit more.
Yeah. But again, thank you so much for coming through. And I mean, hopefully you can come back another time when the hunt is out as well.
That'd be awesome. Yeah,
that'd be awesome. Well, thank you very much. And we'll talk to you another time.
Thanks.
Thanks, B. This has been Dirty Thunder Radio Club. Catch you all next time.